I was starting my own business, and at the time, home was everything because it was where I worked. And I built it from scratch, literally from rubbish, because I remember there was a building site that took forever, maybe took 2 years, and everything in my home came from the building site. And I would, at night, I would jump the fence and I would like scavenge, and I would find like an avocado green shower pan and a cooker that worked perfectly well and chairs that just needed a new leg and like, you know, everything in the flat, like a sink, tiles that I repurposed. Like I did the entire flat out of salvaged materials, and that's it. It was actually featured in an Italian decor magazine.
Hello and welcome to the Homing In podcast. I'm Matt Gibbard, co-founder of The Modern House. My guest today is the industrial designer Philippe Malouin. Philippe designs everything from furniture to lighting, and he combines modern geometry with a sense of humour and materials that are built to last. I first met him many years ago when he was doing some work with my wife, Faye Toogood. We turned our little bedroom into a makeshift design studio, and Philippe and a few others would come round to make maquettes and generally geek out about ergonomics. Nowadays, he's a burly, bearded bear of a man with definitely an extra 20 kilos or so of muscle, but his wit and warmth is very much the same as I remember. He tells me about what it was like to grow up beside a lake in Canada. From the age of 7, he would take himself off in his boat for the whole day, catching fish and swimming off all the islands. This independent, practical spirit has continued into adult life. He largely works on his own, mainly because that's how he likes it. His studio in Hackney, where we met to record this conversation, is the epicentre of his creative output, a place where he can build something or obsess over which type of screw he's going to use or just sit and daydream. He tells me what it's like to create a home from stuff that others have thrown away, how he saved up to buy his favourite sofa and kept it wrapped in plastic for 2 years, and why space is the ultimate luxury. Here it is, and I very much hope you enjoy it. So we will start at the beginning of your journey through the different places you've lived in. So I know you grew up in Canada, right? Which part of Canada was it?
It's called Salaberry de Valleyfield.
Okay.
It's very catchy. It's an hour, I'd say 40 minutes west of Montreal.
Okay.
It's a small town with a lake, and there's a regatta in the summer, and you know, my parents were the town lawyers.
Oh, were they really?
Yeah.
Was it quite a well-to-do kind of place?
Parts of it were, and some parts weren't.
Yeah.
A lot of cities can be wrong side of the tracks, right side of the tracks.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Definitely. And there definitely was a thing. That's where the train tracks were.
quite literally.
Literally,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what was your home like?
We were very lucky because we grew up on a big century-old lake house on Lake St. Francis. So it was really, we grew up quite privileged until my dad lost everything in the mid-80s. and then we kept the house. My mom kept the house, and life was very different. But we grew up with abundance, and then that was very much taken away. I'd say wrong investments, and our lives definitely changed. And I think it's a good thing. I think it made my sister and I maybe different, less privileged people and more hardworking, and definitely worked really hard to get ahead. And
yeah.
So that was a, yeah. So
quite formative, yeah.
Yeah, it was formative, but also it's definitely not a sob story. It's things that happen, and
yeah.
it's not terrible.
Yeah. So how old were you when that shift happened?
Eight years old.
Okay.
Yeah.
So talk to me about pre-8 years old. So you were living on a lake.
Oh yeah, living on the lake. So the lake house and the ski house and the house in Florida. And so that's basically when you're Canadian, you need to get away. When it gets too cold, you go to Florida. And on most weekends, you go skiing because that's what you do. That's what a lot of Canadians do. Also, we had this interesting, very Canadian life, fishing in the summer, boating. I had my own boat, boating around, going to islands, catching dinner, literally fishing, things like that, bringing it back home. And then the winter would come, and it would be the winter wonderland, and skiing. And when a lot of kids in Canada, they get put into ski school when they're young. So ski school every weekend. Yeah, that is very Canadian. What can I say? A very traditional Canadian.
Wholesome. It sounds good. Was it happy?
Yeah, very. It was, everything was great until the divorce. But we were very lucky. We had lots of friends. We played around. And actually, to be fair, when the divorce happened, my mom kept the lake house and my dad went to the countryside, and we had cows and things like that. So we had, I couldn't have been more Canadian. It was lots of exploring, camping, boating, things like that. Very much being outdoors all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so nice, isn't it? After the age of eight, then you're splitting your time between the two homes, right?
Yeah.
What did that, out of interest, what did that do to your sense of home? Because suddenly lots of kids deal with this stuff. Suddenly you're having to split yourself a bit. Where were you mainly based and how was that kind of experience?
I was mainly based with my mom and we had the lake house. And that's where I went to school and until I was 18. So that's where we stayed. And definitely had its advantages, but it was a bit, both houses, to be fair, were quite a bit secluded. And then they were in small towns and I already liked art and I liked music and they weren't things that were incredibly accessible where I was. I adored being where I was. And then obviously when you're 12 and became skateboarding and all those things that you do in the summer instead of, and when you live in a small town in Canada in the summer, you either get into trouble or you do something else. We went skateboarding because that was the main thing to do. And you need to find something to fill your summers with when you're a teenager. But I always knew that I wanted to leave the small town and go to Montreal. And then eventually it was France and Paris and the Netherlands and back here to London. But yeah, it was lots of traveling.
Okay. And it strikes me that you're obviously someone that's always liked the act of making things, right? Mm. Since you're a kid, presumably.
Yeah.
Tell me about that when you were a child then. What kind of stuff did you make and why, do you think?
I think out of boredom, when maybe it was raining and we couldn't be outside, or in the autumn, we had a big workshop in the house I grew up in. And then we just constantly, I made things either like soap boxes. I don't know if you have that in UK. It's the soap boxes.
It's like a little car.
A racing car. Yeah, yeah. A little racing car that you go down a hill. It doesn't have a motor. Like building things like that. And then through skateboarding, you build skate ramps and rails and all of those things. And then, and then I remember like small sculptures and small even paintings, and that was definitely always something you would do, because when you live in a place that's a bit more secluded and not in the center of things, you need to keep busy. We had video games and I liked them enough, but I always preferred doing other things, and making things seemed to always make sense. We always had wood. We always had, as I said, we had a big workshop and we had a big property, which meant lots of tools to upkeep it. And then a lot of those tools, then I made things with.
And who taught you to do that? Or did you just teach yourself?
Yeah, I just taught myself. Although we had a groundskeeper when I was young called Lindor, and Lindor was very patient and taught me a few things. Obviously, we had a bandsaw. And I remember a bandsaw, when used right, is quite safe. And you could literally cut everything with a bandsaw, and it's not too dangerous for an 8-year-old kid to use. I say that now, but actually I probably wouldn't let an eight-year-old use a bandsaw, but I guess things are different when you're in the countryside. Like I had my boat at 7 and then I would leave for the day with it, with sandwiches, and come back at night.
Would you really? On your own?
Yeah. And then no one was worried. It's a different time and place. Yeah. Really. You know, my mom's quite a worrisome person. She wasn't worried. I'd just come back. I'd go, you know, get fish off different islands and swim and pick up a friend. And
that's idyllic, isn't it, actually?
Yeah, it really is. Like, I would never let, I don't have kids, but if I had kids, I would never let my 7-year-old take off on a boat. Like,
same. I wouldn't let my 10-year-old do it.
That's insane.
Yeah.
It made a lot of sense, and all the kids did it. Either it was taking off on a windsurf or taking off, you know, on the lake somehow, or swimming, or it was just normal. That's what all the kids did. So, so making things and, you know, using the drills and the bandsaws, and the chop saw I couldn't use, though. That's one thing. And I remember my dad really told me off I wanted to just try it really quickly. And then I think I was grounded. Yeah. So the chop saw is a big no, because it's true. Also, chops are super dangerous. But like the rest of the stuff was fine. And I would take things apart, like old skateboards or even old furniture, and kind of redo it. Although I didn't really know what I was doing. But painting things, painting on things, making a mess.
Doing this like on your own a lot of the time.
Yeah, always.
Yeah. So actually you're spending, it sounds, quite a lot of time creatively in your own head, because you're building stuff, you're going out on your boat, as you say, on little trips. Do you feel like you've always been quite independent in that way?
Yeah, definitely. Especially, as I said, when you're in a house that's a bit secluded, and my friends were a bit further away, and my school was a bigger drive to get to. Mm. So you, I suppose it's the same as you and your kids living in the countryside. You have to make up your own games and your own fun.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the cool, crazy city is not there. So you got to entertain yourself. And yeah, so a lot of it had to relied on being creative. And I had an aunt who had an art school, so that probably had a lot to do with it. Suzanne, she had an art music school, and then we were there every week. So we were learning to play instruments and to make things. Now, I remember the art class was very, very liberal, as in you could really do whatever you wanted and call it art. I remember doing these crazy sculptures by using the little stones you have in a driveway.
What's it called? Gravel.
Yeah, gravel. I remember like you mixing gravel with paint and glue and making these giant like colorful gravel sculptures.
Oh, right.
Like when I was maybe 8, 9, and then they, I remember they were in the entrance when you walked into the school. I was really proud. And but they, the great thing is, even though it was a really small city, doing things like abstract art was completely encouraged. And my aunt was amazing, and she, I guess that's where it all comes from, actually, now in retrospect.
That's a really interesting influence, isn't it? So did it matter to you at that age what things looked like? Do you think you were aware of aesthetics?
I think when it came to painting, I was obsessed with it, and I was really angry that I couldn't paint figuratively well enough. And I would do it over and over again. I would get bits of cardboard and then get paint and try to copy all the paintings in the house. And then like I'd go from painting to painting, and then like one would be good. Because I would do it with pastels, and I would do that. And then the next one I tried with oil paint, and it wouldn't work. And it wasn't. So yeah, I would try to copy. Whereas like the rest wasn't that important what it looked like, I think. But like the, I remember the paintings, and I'm terrible at drawing. I can't draw to save my life. But I was obsessed with making a good painting, and it never happened. Yeah.
Do you paint now?
No. No, I really don't. I can't draw. I'm a terrible.
Yeah.
I'm a terrible freehand designer.
Yeah,
but that's what I have a computer for.
Exactly.
It's funny because like I remember in university, the first year or two in university, you had the design geeks, and then the design geeks would be like the coolest because they could draw the best and they could do the best computer renders and all this stuff, and they would make fun of me because I wasn't good at drawing, and I tried and tried and I just wasn't very good.
Fair enough. I don't blame you, nor was I. So thinking about school a moment, like how did you get on at school? Were you academically capable? Were you the kind of arty kid? What sort of kid were you?
I was very, very much in my head and not really paying attention. But if I decided I was going to work hard, then I would excel. Maybe through high school. I remember for some reason I thought I had to study mathematics and science because that was the right, was the right path for you to become a success. And then I wanted to, I think I was interested in even becoming a doctor. And so I did mathematics and science. I was terrible at math and not great at science either. And I had taken, between college and university, I took a gap year to, and then I came to Europe, and then I saw different people that were doing different things. And then when I came back, I was not really doing anything interesting, working as a waiter. And then my mom forced me to go and do an orientation class at a university to figure out what it is that I was going to do. And then they figured out that I needed to go to art school. And then that's what I did. So I went to art school, and when I got in, I did very well. Mm-hmm. So the first year foundation course, you did graphic design, photography, film, editing, everything. And I took all of it super seriously. And yeah, I knew that if you went to University of Montreal and then you had straight A's for 2 years, you were given a bursary program. So I got a straight A average for 2 years. And then I got a bursary and I went to study in France.
Why France, out of interest?
There's this school called Les Ateliers Annecy in Paris, which is a very good school. And at the time, it was one of the best schools they had that you could do an exchange with. And I remember there was a teacher called François Zambourg, who's a designer that I admired. I just really wanted to go. In Canada, there isn't furniture brands like there are in Europe. But then I knew that going to a school like this would put me one step closer to it, because I was always interested in industrial design, but I wanted to do furniture. And I was well aware that it couldn't happen in Canada. I needed to go to Europe. So I went to Les Ateliers. And I think our first group project for school was with Hermès. It was like very, when you come from a small town outside of Montreal to this, it's night and day. And then I did an internship in Amsterdam at the studio called JEP. And then they got me into Design Academy Eindhoven, and I never came back to Canada. I knew that I couldn't, if this is what I wanted to do. Now times have changed, obviously. I think because of the internet, Instagram, you can be in Canada, you can be in other places and have a piece of the very difficult pie that is furniture design.
But you felt in Canada you just never get a look in.
No. At the time, no. And at the time it wasn't possible. And still, to be fair, if you want to be noticed these days, you need to go to a certain school, either it be fashion or graphics or whatever. You know, you need to go to Central St. Martin's if you want to do fashion. If you want to do product design, you need to go to ECAL. There's those schools all around the world that get you a step up. I think it's still the case.
Yeah. Okay, so after leaving there, where did you go?
So I went to do an internship in the Netherlands. Then my boss got me into Design Academy Eindhoven. And then I worked really hard. I worked really hard to graduate. And then at the time, it was the director of the school was Lee Edelcourt. And Lee had this extremely popular view of how the school was communicated. And Eindhoven was the show to see in Milan. And it was this boiling, effervescent school. And then every year, she would select 8 kids to represent the school in Milan. And I was lucky enough to be one of those 8 kids when I graduated. I had really silly things. I had an inflatable table and I had a chair that was like a clothes hanger. But then we showed in Milan. And then I think a week later, my work was in New York Times, wallpaper, frame. It was a different time in terms of, it was very, very publicized design schools. People really cared what was coming out of Design Academy. And I got a job for Tom Dixon and I came to work for him freelance 3 days a week. And the rest of the time I was doing my own thing. And maybe a year and a half in, I became too busy. So I did my own thing. I stopped working for Tom and I've been doing my own thing ever since.
And what did Tom see in you? How come he took you on, do you think?
I really don't know. I have no idea. I wasn't particularly good at drawing. I was okay at making things, but I guess he thought I was funny. I think that's probably the best.
And what did you learn from being there for a year and a half?
I think it's brilliant to work for someone else, especially when you want to be a product designer, because you can't. Some kids do. I didn't. When you finish school, finding what your style is and what your vision is and what your aesthetic is really hard because you're so young and you haven't seen that much. And to learn to design for someone else, which I have done, obviously, for a few people at the time, because when you're young, you got to survive. So I did that for Tom. And then I freelanced at a few design studios to help with design. And then when you design for other people, you definitely see what it is that you want and what it is that you don't want. And during this time, you can develop your own style and your own narrative. And yeah, so that's what a really good thing is to work for someone else. I think everybody should work for someone else. And then sometimes the right thing is for you to continue working for someone else. And sometimes you just want to work for yourself. I always knew I wanted to work for myself. That was like from day one in university. I wanted to have my studio. I wanted to design furniture. And I really had it all planned. I had the plan. I knew I was going to end up in Europe and I wanted to go to that school and I wanted to end up at Eindhoven. And anyway, right. So it was one track mind. But the good thing is that it led me here and now I get to do that for a living.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it worth it?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. But I'm incredibly lucky. I was at the right place at the right time. I had enough. And also, it's important to know your privilege. I had enough privilege so that my parents could, at the time, afford to send me to school in Europe. Although, to be fair, Eindhoven was €1,000 a year. That was a tuition fee. And to send your kid to Europe and get him a flat and all this stuff. Like, I was privileged enough to be able to do that. So that's really important. And then I got to be at the right place at the right time. And I got lucky. When luck had a lot to do with it, obviously.
Yeah, it always does for everyone, I think, doesn't it? But it's good to acknowledge that, definitely. Because you and I met, it feels like a lifetime ago now, but you were doing some work with Faye. We'd converted our bedroom, hadn't we, actually, in Canterbury into a kind of little makeshift studio. It's coming back to me now.
Yeah.
So we had to, I seem to remember like having to take the bed out of the room and you guys came in the morning or something. It was all the things that you do when you're a young designer, right? What are your memories of that period. And what did you do with Faye? Because at the time I wasn't particularly aware of, and I'm trying to remember what you were doing at that stage.
I would come in once a week and I would advise on furniture,
yeah,
design a few things, yeah, and then the rest of the staff would continue while I was gone. And so I was doing my own studio, and then once a week for maybe, I think, 6 months, I would, yeah, I'd come in and design a few things with Faye, and then we'd just have chats about what we thought was interesting for the studio. Mm. And yeah, so it was after working for Tom, and then I think I was getting the hang of seeing what worked and what didn't work. Yeah. And so, yeah, so we worked on that for a little while, and then, yeah, I couldn't do a day a week anymore. And then,
yeah,
I left and
fully, yeah, set up on your own.
Yeah. And I can't believe it worked out.
Just a quick one. I'm really pleased to say that this podcast is sponsored by one of my all-time favorite brands, Vitsu. Over the past 25 years or so, I've been very lucky to visit hundreds of beautifully designed living spaces. And if I could name one product that I've seen more than any other, it would have to be the 606 Universal Shelving System from Vitsu. I think the reason that so many people from the creative industries live with Vitsu's shelving is because it's so incredibly versatile, both functionally and visually. It works in big spaces and small ones, modern places, traditional places, townhouses and country houses. And the key to its success, I think, is that it's been paired back to its absolute essentials. Dieter Rams, who conceived it back in 1960, famously said that good design is as little design as possible. And I couldn't agree more with that. To find out more about this brilliant product, you can visit vitsu.com. That's vitsoe.com. Right, back to the podcast.
Let's talk then about the present day. So we're sitting in your fantastic studio in East London.
Yeah.
Just describe it to us a minute. How long have you been here, and what is this building and where are we?
Okay, so we're in Hacking Central. I'm in a studio that is part of a foundation, and I've been in the building for 10 years now, I think. And at the height of COVID, a lot of people were having trouble, and because studios here never are available, never happens.
Why is that?
They're central, they're priced, and we're part of our foundation. So people just stay because, yeah, it would be insane to go. And then one studio, because I was in a smaller studio on the ground floor, and then the studio on the first floor became available with like kitchen, running water, space for a workshop, space for furniture, space to work. Which, in, you know, in London is very hard to find. Mm. Like, I think it's funny because, like, I have some American friends who come here, and then, like, I'm really proud of the studio. But then they're from, like, Brooklyn, and they come here, and they're like, yeah, it's all. I don't think they realize what premium space is, especially in workspaces in London. But, yeah, and I got it literally when COVID started, and I did it up. I put in a workshop. I put in the floors, painted it, and just made it nice and clean and bright.
It works very hard for what is not a huge space, because as you say, you've got a workshop area, you've got a kind of quiet sort of working at the computer area for a few people, right?
We could do five people max.
Yeah.
At the time there was always three, minimum three.
Yeah.
To be fair, I had from, I'd say, 2010 until maybe a year ago, I always had minimum three people here all the time.
Yeah. And what would they be doing?
Okay, so Julian Camosa was my assistant for, I'd say, 8 years. And Julian was my right-hand man, designer, incredibly talented, super lovely person. Because at any given moment, the studio is working on 4 pieces of furniture, maybe, okay, for different brands, like all around the world, from Japan to Copenhagen, to Italy, to America. So a lot of this work was done between Julian and I, and then we'd have an assistant and an intern also. Right now I only do furniture for mass production and I get royalties from it. It's a very antiquated model, very old school. And sadly, not many people can make a living from that. It's very hard because you need to have enough products that are out there. You need to be with big enough brands with a big enough distribution that are selling well enough for you to, because when you think about it, you make between 3% and 5% of.
Yeah. So let's just explain that. So you design something.
Yeah.
You take a royalty of 3% to 5% from every product.
Wholesale.
That's sold. Wholesale.
Yeah.
That's sold. You've got to sell a hell of a lot of chairs
or
tables
yes.
to make that viable. So what you're saying is you need a a huge number of products to be successful, to make a living from that.
Yeah.
So you're now, are you working on your own now?
Now I'm working on my own, because basically before we were working on all kinds of projects. Working on, we did interiors for a while. We worked with Aesop. We worked with big American rap people, whoever they are.
Is that right? Yeah, because you did a headquarters for Aesop, didn't you? Where they're all there.
Yeah, yeah. And then we designed a shop in Scotland, and then we're helping. Yeah, we're doing different brands, and we did. It was called Post Office, and my friend Sasha and I started it together. And then we did Mother, the ad agency. We did a lot of, we were quite good at designing offices, actually.
Yeah, must have been.
Yeah, we're okay.
Brands like that.
But you need staff to do that. And then also we're doing like large scale art installations and design installations and all kinds of, because before you're trusted by a big company to design a chair that's going to be mass produced, or a light that's going to be mass produced, before you're trusted to do that, you need to have a lot of experience under your belt. And yeah, so now I'm lucky enough that being just me in the studio, I can make a living, a modest living. I'm not rolling around in a vintage Porsche 911. I'm rolling around on a bicycle.
A nice bicycle.
It's a nice bicycle. It's true. It's a nice bicycle my friends gave me for my 40th birthday. An Eddie Merckx Motorola 1990 World Cup, I think it is.
There you go.
Yeah, so it's quite nice, quite a fancy bike. But as I said, so I'm lucky enough to make a decent wage, decent living. And I was so used to working with a team and really lovely, talented people. But now I've changed my ways and I get very quiet and very focused. And I get into this strange working zone where I like to be alone and not have anyone around. So maybe it's a stage of my life, but I find that I'm designing the things I really want to design right now. But also, as that's to be said, I'm working with fantastic companies at the moment. And that definitely means that if what we're working on is right, then things are going to be better. And I'm just very lucky to be working with these brands right now.
So roughly how many products do you have out there that are paying you royalties?
Maybe 20?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's only a few products that are very much bringing in the bread and butter.
They're at the kind of right stage in their evolution.
This is the offset stool and coffee table for a resident is very popular.
It's a beautiful collection, I think. It's really lovely.
Yeah.
And so I'm not surprised.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. But also it's the simple things are the best things. And actually that a stool like that can work in any environment.
Yeah. And it was in the dressing rooms at Cause worldwide. And it's very popular it works for very sort of chic, more upscale interiors. And it works also for the more designy, minimal interiors for some reason. It's a fun piece.
Yeah.
It's unusual, but it's extremely classic. Even though you have 20 pieces out there, and people will often think that the biggest brands will be your biggest income.
Right.
But that's not the case. But I'm not naming any one in particular, but some things do extremely well and some things do okay. You can't always read the zeitgeist properly. Mm. Also, I don't look at design websites. I don't look at magazines. I don't really know what the zeitgeist is. Mm. I just do what I like and then sometimes it works.
So what would be your process for starting, let's say, a stool? What would you do?
So there's two ways of going about it. So we're sitting in the studio right now, and there's a bunch of things just sitting on a shelf. And sometimes you could have made an experiment by folding a piece of foam. And eventually this thing that will be on the shelf, the right brief will come along. And this you realize this is perfect. And then you start reworking it and you present it to the client. So that's one way to go about it. That's a way that I do that happens actually quite often. And otherwise, there's the traditional sketch, evolve, research model. Another way I definitely work is researching a ton of art and architecture and work with photographs that I pin on the wall. And then you compose an idea of something by having the foot of one thing and then the tabletop of another. And then you mix it together and then you mix it with a piece of art and Yeah, and then you go back to sketching and computer work, and we call it cooking. So there's a really systematic way to design things when you design it, such as like the diameter of a leg. If you're working on a table, you will do 10 versions of the same table with 10 different diameters. And then you put them all in a view together, and then it's clear. And it's funny because that's my way of working, but maybe not everyone works that way. But then it's clear that out of the 10, you'll immediately identify the right one, because you don't know the right one until if you've only done two. You need like a bunch to realize. And then once you've done that, you bring the table down, and then you, the tabletop thickness, you do 10 different ones, and then you bring that one down. So it's like an elimination process. And then until you cook it and you cook it and you cook it, and it's perfect. So it could be the angle of a backrest, it could be the diameter, it could be the thickness of a piece of metal, and then so on and so forth, until you distill it to being just right.
Yeah.
So all the avenues of working, they will always end up through there, through this distilling process.
Okay. I read a quote of yours, which I liked, which is you said, "I'm a big fan of simple products that showcase a certain imperfection while still being industrially perfect." What do you mean by that?
A good example is the offset stool here. It's a perfectly made stool that's made of oak, and it's got a screw insert inside of it. But the idea for it came when I was trying to put legs on a table prototype, and I screwed the leg insert incorrectly so that the leg became offset from its center, and it stuck out of the tabletop. And then that was clear as day that it would make a fantastic product, because it's perfectly made, but it's completely imperfect. All of the legs sit in a different place, a different spot. And that's what gives it its presence. So when you have an error that can also become an aesthetically pleasing component, but also it makes it unusual. And then why wouldn't it be produced perfectly? I don't necessarily believe in completely imperfectly produced products. On the other hand, if you buy furniture, especially with the cost of living and the cost of materials these days, furniture is expensive. So if you buy something, it needs to last a lifetime, at least. So it needs to be well made.
Exactly. It's definitely solid, despite being offset.
Yeah, but it needs to be solid. It needs to be sober. It can't be trendy. If it's too trendy, it needs to be have the capacity to be resold. So to me, that is a green product. That's a sustainable product. Is a product not only that obviously uses renewable materials, but that is designed a certain way that will retain value and will be traded and then will never end up in landfill. Because something can be greenwashly produced, but it will end up in landfill because it's not built to last. So there's a dichotomy here.
So tell me about you. You're in here on your own now. What's your kind of ritual through the day? Do you have a pattern to how you use the space?
Oh, yeah. I cycle through Hackney Downs. I go get a sausage roll every morning. And I get to the studio. The first thing I do is make coffee, obviously, and put on my headphones and listen to NTS radio. And that's what I like also about being alone right now, is that I don't need to perform being the boss that knows what he's doing. Sometimes I can look at magazines or literally just stare into space, zone out, or be there. And I don't have a schedule. I have a schedule when I have products that clients require. But as it's just me right now, I can't schedule that many clients. So it needs to be clients that have a similar way of thinking. And then we're aligned. And obviously we like each other and I like the brand. And one of the big advantages of being alone is selecting the work you want to work on and saying no to other things. So yeah, so different days mean different things. Sometimes I'll start by cleaning the studio. I'm quite manic in a way. I'm not really disciplined. Either I'll be all into working and I'll be producing technical drawings and 3D files, or I'll just be really irresponsible and mess about the studio and do not very much. Or I'll stay until midnight and then work really hard. So yes, I think the main thing about the studio is it's a place that is not home. So I think I don't have discipline. So if I was to stay home and try to work, that would never happen.
Okay.
Never, ever. I need to leave home and then come to this other space that's suited perfectly for working. So I have everything here. I have all of the tools. I have samples. I have wood samples, steel samples, plastic samples, everything. So I can try something out. And coming here just allows me to be in a different headspace. And having a studio is really important, I think, if you're a creative. Some people like to work from home, but I really don't.
Yeah, because it's interesting, because we asked you to pick three homes, right? One
yes.
from your past, one from your present, and one from your future.
Yes.
And you chose this studio as like your home of the present, which I think is symbolic, right? Is that because you actually feel most comfortable when you're at work?
I do. I think home is a very, I think home is a quiet place that's relaxing. Yeah. And but it's very much been designed to do that. Mm. Whereas the studio is definitely a place to be creative, and it's definitely not a place to live. So if I'm here, I'm very comfortable, but also I'm very aware that the studio is a tool. It's just a big tool to use to create work. So it definitely, the way I designed it, it's comfortable. You can come and be on your phone on the sofa if you want, and then you can be working on a prototype also if you want. So I guess the studio, the reason why I choose the studio is always because of work. It sounds boring, but like, it's my whole life, what I do. It is work, but it's not work because I'm obsessed with it, because I think about it all the time. I think about it when I'm home, on the bike, on the train. I use the notes app on the phone, and then I draw with it all the time. So yeah, it's not work necessarily for me. It's really, I'm just super lucky to be doing it. I chose the studio because it's my whole life, and it's all here. Not everything, sadly. I wish I could have everything I designed here, but I have a lot of the evolution of everything we've done here. So it's a good place to be, and it reminds you of the work you've done and the work that's left to be done.
It's so interesting, I think, because a lot of people, probably myself included, actually would find it quite difficult to spend that much time in my own company, actually, in my own headspace. And maybe this goes back to what you're saying about being a kid and actually going off on your own. So you're very used to that. But are there ever times when you feel you're too much in your own company?
Yeah, and definitely. And a friend of mine who's a brilliant interior designer, Deidre, she's in New Zealand right now. But she was coming in a few days a week to work from here, which I liked. She's quiet, and I'm quiet too. And then, but just having someone here, how can I put this? Having someone here that doesn't work for you is really nice, because she does her work, I did my work, and I could disappear in my headphones and do my thing. But I also very much like my own company. I don't find it sad to be on my own. I have lots of lovely friends that I see outside of work. But right now, maybe in that stage that I am at, I just really like to be in my bubble and focus on really minute details, how some type of screw to use or type of joint to use, or do research and pin things and really be geeky and not really have to answer to anyone.
And how else do you make sure that you're in the right headspace? As we all do, we have to make sure that we look after ourselves mentally. Do you go to the gym? What's your kind of thing?
Gym every day.
Gym every day.
Yeah, before coming to the studio.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely every day. So that definitely is part of the body-mind consortium. But also, you can't be here every day. You can't be at the studio every day. So some days, as I said, I'm really lucky. It's just me. So some days I just go and walk around the South Bank, and I go to the Hayward, or I go eat Chinese food in town, and I'll do the galleries, and I'll walk around and be inspired. And sometimes I'll do that for a whole week. I don't need to. Obviously, I have deadlines and I need to produce work, but I don't have to be here all the time. So that's how I'm really lucky, because you can be in a headspace that when you're ready to work, you work. When you're not, you don't. And when you need to be inspired, you go and get inspired. You can't produce all the time. It doesn't work that way.
Mm. Yeah. It's interesting what you said about going to the gym, because if you don't mind me saying, your physical appearance is very different from when I first met you, right? You're kind of more broad bean than string bean these days.
Yes.
And it's really striking, because you're a tall guy as well, so you've got a serious physical presence now. Is that a deliberate thing, or is that sort of a byproduct of going to the gym? Is that a form of sort of protection in some way, or how would you characterize it?
I think it's just something I was always interested in, and I never gave it enough time until I was able to. And going to a gym and bodybuilding, you need to work out, and you need to eat well, you need to be disciplined, you need to go every day, you need to take it seriously. And as results start to happen, you want to keep going. And it was very organic. It wasn't too premeditated. It was just something that happened over the years. And if you go to the gym every day for 15 years, your body will change.
Yeah.
For sure.
And what are you getting out of it when you're doing it, would you say?
I think clarity and you're grumpy about something, you could definitely use it as a tool to do well in the gym. And I think definitely physical exercise is linked to health. There's a great correlation between actual physical exercise and dementia and how it reduces chances of our cardiovascular problems. I think just generally it's a way to take care of your mental health and your body health. And I suppose that it makes me relaxed in a way that I really don't think I would be if I didn't go every day.
Yeah.
I feel like there's something missing. Although cheat days are great when you stay home on a Sunday and you eat cold pizza and you don't go to the gym. That's also really great.
But if they're like, because
everything needs to be done in moderation. You need to want to do everything. I think that's success. I don't think success is necessarily money for me, because like, also I'm a furniture designer. As I said, I'll never be crazy rich, and that's completely fine. But I am rich in the sense that I get to do what I want. So if I want to go to the gym, if I want to come to work, if I want to not come to work, if I want to go see my friends in Los Angeles for a whole month in January because I don't have to be here, I can do that, and I can work from over there. So I think choice is luxury, and I get to basically do that.
Yeah. And so if you break that routine of, let's say, going to the gym every day, do you feel out of kilter somehow?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It feels like something's wrong, but also that's problematic because you're used to feeling and looking a certain way. And if you don't go for a month, you see some pretty big changes. So it's something that you need to upkeep constantly. Yeah. So it's like it's like a home. It's like a home. You gotta keep the shutters clean and you gotta dig out the leaves from the gutters and you gotta give it a fresh coat of paint and redo the driveway and mow the lawn. And it is. It's a well-oiled machine.
You gotta plump the cushions, haven't you? Are you someone that, do you get anxious? Do you get depressed sometimes? Do you suffer from mental
anxiety? Definitely. I think everybody these days do after COVID, especially.
Yeah. Do you feel that?
Yeah, for sure. To be fair, I was very zen during lockdown, during COVID, because there was very little traveling to do. There was very little interaction. So I was very relaxed. I think when things opened up again, anxiety levels came rising up. And so definitely something like going to the gym, it really helps me focus and not be overtaken by anxiety. Because either it's financial, or I'm not a big fan of small enclosed spaces, and I'm usually on a plane, let's say maybe twice a month, three times a month. So it becomes a lot. I'm not a fan of traveling, so I need to do it all the time because I need to go sign off a chair in Stockholm, and I need to go see a light in Italy. And so, yeah, most of my life is on the plane. So I guess that's related to that.
Yeah. We talked about your studio.
Yeah.
In terms of your flat, where you live, where does that come into the equation? How important is that space in your life as well?
The flat is very important because I bought it. As I said, I came to London. My first 4 years in London, I think I made 12,000 a year. And I don't even know how you survive doing that in London. It was a different time. It goes back to 2008. You need a lot less money to live in London back then. I think where I lived at the time was and I think that first flat meant a lot, because that space meant a lot, because I lived and I worked from an old warehouse, and they let us do anything we wanted to the studio. I went to tap the main water, and then I brought it to the flat, and then I built a shower, and I built a kitchen. And I remember, and also I was incredibly poor. And then my parents cut me off. Like, there was no money coming. I couldn't be like, Dad, Mom, help me out. There was none of that. And then I was freelancing for Tom Dixon. I was starting my own business. And at the time, home was everything, because it was where I worked. And I built it from scratch, literally from rubbish, because I remember there was a building site that took forever, maybe took 2 years. And everything in my home came from the building site. And at night, I would jump the fence and I would like scavenge, and I would find like an avocado green shower pan and a cooker that worked perfectly well, and chairs that just needed a new leg, and like, you know, everything in the flat, like a sink, tiles that I repurposed. Like, I did the entire flat out of salvaged materials, and that's it. It was actually featured in an Italian decor magazine. And then I got to work there, and that was my first working space. And I got my first interns to come work there. And eventually, after I think 7 years of living there, I scraped enough money together, and then I bought a flat. And that was completely new thing, because then it became the separation from everything all at once, which is living, working, and literally I built a mezzanine on top of the workspace, so there'd be like screws and nails and all kinds of crap, and then I slept on top of that. And then when you have a home, that's why the flat is so special to me, because after 7 years of live work, it was a place to live and a place to work, and then those really separated, and I had never experienced that before. So
how did that change things for you?
Home is definitely like the door closes and it's relaxing. Whereas before, you would walk in and, like I said, there would be wood shavings on the floor and glue, and you forgot to take the soldering iron out of the wall and something was burning. And yeah, so that really changed it, like just the capacity of spaces to put you in a mood. So work is very much for working. It's a tool. Work is a tool. My studio is a tool, and my home is, I want to say, a spa, because I find it so comfortable. And I put all the lovely things that I have been collecting for years into it, and it's nice and quiet and comfortable.
So what, tell us about some of those things. What have you collected?
Just a very nice rug from a lovely dealer called Suad LaRussi that you probably know, and I've known her forever. Mm. I think Helena Bangsbo Anderson from Tom Dixon introduced me to her back in the days. And throughout the years, saving, because when you're a young designer, you can't just buy a 5,000 pound rug, but you can save for it. And I've definitely always been a saver until I can afford to buy the thing that I want. I never wanted to go and buy something from a big store, I won't name it, but that never really was interesting to me. So I remember my first 3,000 pounds that I made that I didn't have to pay either the heating or something with. I went, there was a sale at Harrods, and then I went to buy a Togo sofa by Michel Ducaroy for Ligne Rosset. I always wanted it since I was a teenager. I absolutely needed it. And I remember I had that sofa wrapped up in plastic in my previous live work flat for 2 years, because I wasn't sure I was going to get that money again, and I didn't want the sofa to get messed up, and I didn't touch it for 2 years until I bought the flat, and then it went into the flat. I gave the sofa to my ex.
Did you?
Yeah, but that's the whole story. But yeah, and then eventually it became my sofa that replaced that. But I try not to have too much of my own things in my flat. Other people's work is much better than my work.
So do you not like living with your own stuff?
Not really, no. No, I won't if I don't have to.
Why? Because it'll just irritate you?
It just irritates me. Also, I don't get designers that are like living in their own stuff and like living the whole like, I don't know, idea of themselves. I like my work. I find it great in other people's homes. And then, I don't know, I think it's really good. I wouldn't say it's the best. What artist can literally say their work is the best?
Yeah.
Anyway, I can't say that. And I just love, I love finding things. I love collecting things. Like the bed, like for instance, my bed, I always knew is the super oblong bed for Capeline by Jasper Morrison. Like I knew from the day it came out that was going to be my bed. And it was insanely expensive, but I saved for it until I could afford it. But it's about collecting and taking your time and wanting things and wanting them for a long time. And if you get rid of it, you can always sell it. You can always sell it. It never needs to go in the trash. If you like get the right thing, if you ponder about what you're buying, it'll always retain value. And then if anything, a little bit of wear and tear these days is actually even desirable.
What are you looking for in those things? Let's say, why the Jasper Morrison bed?
It's the best bed.
But why?
It's comfortable. The backrest is padded. It's got around 220 mil of padding. It's just like his super oblong sofa collection. That is, you've seen that. It's the best, in a way, it's one of the best sofas. It's been copied by every, I don't want to use the word copied, but it's been interpreted by every major brand, a version of the super oblong, which originally actually came out and it was much more of a, it didn't have structure, and then it was a beanbag and you zip them up together. And it was like the most iconic sofa. And I remember when the bed came out, because I already had a sofa, it was just, yeah, it made complete sense. It was padded. To me, it was the most functional thing because it was padded everywhere. So you're never going to catch your toe on a... Because I can't think of anything more unpleasant than a bed that you catch your toe on. Anyway, it's the perfect bed. It's functional. It's puffy. I don't know. It's the perfect... I don't know. I have those things that are the perfect thing. Like, for instance, like the perfect bin is the VIP bin. There's no reason to look for another bin. It's the perfect bin. The perfect stool is the K65 stool by Alvar Aalto for Artek. There's no reason to get another stool.
Which one's the K65? Yeah. That's the one you've got. Okay, so that's a raised up stool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the perfect counter height. So I have these like very specific thing, like this is the one and there's no better one.
But it's interesting actually, because everything that you've named is contemporary or modern design.
Mm-hmm.
Do you live with any old stuff as well?
Yeah, like I guess, well, I suppose mid-century modern Danish things is still modern. I guess I don't really live with that many old things.
And what would you put that down to?
That's a very interesting question. I probably should. I'm not much of a decorator.
Yeah.
I put furniture in a room, and that to me is decoration. I don't use paint or textures or fabrics or things like that. I think my idea of decoration is just choosing the things that speak to me and that are sculptural in a certain way and that are very functional and do their job really well. I guess modernism does those things for me.
Yeah.
Okay. It's sculptural and it's functional and it's tough.
Let's talk about the future.
Oh, yeah.
Because you said that in the future, if you could,
you
would live in Ricardo Bofill's house in Barcelona, which is called La Fabrica. I'm sure lots of people will be aware of it, but it's an old cement factory that he converted. It's probably the most Instagram space in the world, I'd have thought, pretty much. But it is a phenomenal place. But tell me about why you respond to that.
I think it is not, what I wanted to say is that it is not about that place specifically.
Okay.
It is about the idea of the place.
Yeah.
Because how often can you discover in a major world city, a space like that concrete factory?
Yeah.
So it's not about Ricardo Bofill's house. It's about the capacity to discover something that hasn't been touched or interpreted by humans for living yet and creating your own idea of living. So that's the reason why I chose that.
Okay.
It's just a very good example of an extreme version of discovering an industrial space or a space that's not made for living and you make it into living.
And why does that appeal?
Because living is different for everybody. Some people want a big open space. Some people want many small rooms that they do many different things. Some people want their TV room to be at the top of a tower. Just the capacity to dictate or to discover needs that you didn't even know you had from a predetermined architecture that has nothing to do with living. I just find that so exciting. I just find the capacity of adapting and living a different way incredibly exciting. And maybe it has to do with that sort of warehouse I lived in that I built from garbage.
Yeah.
I've been living in a Victorian flat for a while. And this obviously makes sense with the modern house because the modern house, it sells and it shows Victorian places, but also it started from showing really special places.
Yeah.
That are exactly that are unusual artist made places to live. And it hasn't in my adult life happened to me and probably won't because sadly nowadays in places like London, Paris, New York, Los Angeles, Montreal, everything's been discovered already, which is sad. But just the capacity to develop a new way of living and to improvise what living is probably what I'd love to have in the future.
Okay, so you like the idea of the building partly dictating to you how you're going to use the spaces.
Yeah, I live in my Victorian flat. Is very predetermined where the bedrooms are, where the bathroom is, all of those things. I'd like to be part of the creative living process of a building dictating, not even dictating, giving you different options and possibilities and you choose to accept them or reject them or making your own mark, your own way of living, I think is what interests me. Yeah. And I find that more interesting than starting from scratch personally, because I think starting from scratch, maybe you have predetermined ideas of where or how big a living room should be or the window should face north. That makes a lot of sense, actually, windows facing north. But
why does it?
So that you don't have direct sunlight.
Yeah, and why is that good? Because a lot of people would say that's bad.
Oh.
It's good for an artist, right?
Yeah, it is good for an artist. Yeah. Perhaps I view it that way. So that's another example that I want the light to be constant during the day.
Yeah. Is this north facing, this studio?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And then you're never cooking in the summer because we used to be in a south facing and working in the summer was hell.
Yeah.
But maybe I do see those things personally, the way I would like to see it as an artist.
Yeah.
But to create my own way of living is the future. So it's not so much about Mr. Bofill's cement factory, but just the dream of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as you get older, how do you see the needs of what you demand from your home changing? Let's say spatially as a start, you've got this factory or equivalent, the opportunities are endless. How are you going to, in older age, what are you going to need? And what would be your kind of exciting rooms that you would have in it?
I think having, as I get older, maybe living on one floor will probably be something that's important. But really, space is the ultimate luxury for me. I can't think of anything more luxurious than space that's not being used, or space that has very little in it, or having a 50 square meters in your living space that don't have furniture and that is just left empty to exist.
Right.
So that's probably, when I bought the flat, I think I wanted to feel cozy because I had been living in an industrial space, and I wanted the little rooms, and I wanted the fireplace, and I wanted those very cozy things. Now that I've been living there for 10 years, I think I want the raw, wide open industrial space without walls. And maybe that's how I would like to live. I think everything is cyclical. Like you want certain things at a certain point in your life, and maybe that's what I'll want then. But definitely as I get older, I think proximity to nature and the ocean or the mountain.
I was going to ask you that. If you could plonk this building anywhere, where do you think you'd put it?
Barcelona would be a pretty good place to be, I suppose.
Why is that?
Just proximity to the sea.
The sea and mountains.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you snowboard / ski and you surf, right?
Used to surf.
I haven't surfed
in a while. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Too many muscles for surfing now.
Well, I'm not. Yeah. I'm as svelte as I used to be. Yeah. It requires a lot more cardio than. But definitely some place that I can ski in the winter and go to the sea in the summer, and the woods and the mountains. That's just how I grew up. That's what I know. Or I very much like Los Angeles. Sadly, it's too far. It's too far from the design world, but I did spend January there. I have many friends that live there, and it is the most expensive place. It wasn't always this way, but it became prohibitively expensive, sadly. Yeah, so now buying a place in LA is very different than it used to be. But the fact that all the produce comes from there, and then you can go to the desert, you can go skiing. It's 2 hours to get to Big Bear Mountain, which is something I've done this year. You can go to the ocean. It's all there, and it's sunny all the time, and it's very special. All of the colors are so vivid over there. No wonder so many artists move there over the years.
So climate-wise, you would rather set London aside and go somewhere warmer, right?
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
And what is it about? Is it the light? Is it the heat? What is it?
I think it's just the light and the fact that it's clement to go outside, and you're invited to go outside and spend all this time outside. You're in your friend's backyard, and you... it sounds cliche, but you literally eat avocados off the trees, and you're very much present with nature. Whereas here in London is a fantastic place because it's the most concentrated amount of interesting people and talent, but it's not the most inviting place to spend all this time outdoors.
Yeah, exactly. Do you feel like you won't be in London forever?
I think I'll always have a pied-à-terre maybe here, but as I grow older, I just wonder what it is that I want. And close access, close proximity to nature. That's what you've done. You moved outside of London, you moved to the countryside. Maybe it could be that, or maybe it could be a different country altogether. Maybe it could be Canada. Although the thing about Canada is that you have to wait for the skiing, you have to wait for the mountain, you have to wait for summer, and summer is very quick.
Yeah.
but it is economically stable, and people seem to be happy because there's enough space for everyone and there's enough natural resources for everyone. Mm. That's why Canada is special.
Yeah. Are you a gardener? Would you have a garden, do you think?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I live in a flat with no outdoor space, and that's definitely been weighing on me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so in your fancy concrete bunker.
Yeah.
If I could put it like that. Who would you live with, or would you be on your own?
I think I'd be on my own.
Yeah.
Is that so bad?
It's not so bad at all. Yeah. That's coming across that you're very, I would say, unusually comfortable in your own company.
Yeah. I think I love my friends and I see them as much as I can. But I think I really like the idea of closing a door and having silence. So even if it was in my Actually, if I could buy a house, it would be a Julian Lampen's house. Do you know?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know who that is?
He's Belgian, right?
Yeah, he's a Belgian brutalist.
Yeah.
He's a Belgian brutalist residential architect, which is pretty rare. Mm. And yeah, I'd buy a Julian Lampen's property and that would be very special. And I'd close the door and it would be nice and quiet.
Yeah. And do you have any sort of like bucket list of things that you really want to do?
It would be nice to, perhaps on a financial level, maybe I'd like to have revenue that is constant and it will last forever, such as a property investment and okay. so on. And then once that's out of the way, then all the fun stuff can be the bucket listed. And then who knows, maybe I'll just do a year living in Athens and then so on and so forth. That would be a good one. I love Athens and it's a fantastic city and it hasn't been destroyed yet by international hipsters. But it's about to, so...
Is that right?
I'm part of the problem talking about it right now.
Yeah. Don't want any more of those Canadians rocking up.
Yeah, correct. And then ruining the city.
So the final question I often ask, Philippe, is quite a general one. But when you're in your cement factory in the future and you're looking back over your life, what do you think will give you the most satisfaction of everything that you've done or just who you are as a person?
Oh, wow. That's a very difficult question. That I got lucky enough to do what I think my vocation is.
Yeah.
So I got to do what I wanted to do in life, which is something that not many people are given. So that's probably what I'm most lucky to have done. So I chose what I wanted to do and I got to do what I wanted to do and I got paid for it, which is it's winning the lottery. Yeah, I won the lottery in terms of vocation.
Thanks so much. Really enjoyed it. Really good to see you again.
Yay. Thanks.
Thank you. You got through it.
Thank you to Philippe and thanks to all of you for listening. We really do appreciate it. I've said this before, but it's worth saying again, podcasts like ours really do live or die by the reviews that they get. So if you can spare a second to give us a rating or a quick write-up, that would really help us out. If you're not already subscribed to Homing In, do please tap the follow button as well and you'll be alerted as soon as new episodes come out. This podcast was produced by Hannah Phillips and edited by Oscar Crawford, with music by Father. Thanks again for being here and talk to you all on the next one. Bye for now.